Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guest. And today our guest is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. Now, you know, a lot of people really take freedom for granted. They never stop and think of all the men who have fought and died for freedom in past generations. That down through the ages, men have always wanted to live in a society where they could be free, and yet it was never really accomplished fully, or almost as fully as possible, with imperfect men, until America was established well over 200 years ago. And the very foundation of our freedom is the Constitution of the United States, which was written as a unique type of document, basically based upon the Declaration of Independence, that held that our freedoms come from God, and that to secure those God-given rights, governments instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. Well, unfortunately, there are today, as there have always been throughout all ages, those who would rule other men. Those who hate the Constitution and hate everything it represents because it prevents them from seizing power and ruling. And the difficulty is that they have actually concealed from the average American the true meaning of our Constitution, and the average individual doesn't understand that the purpose of the Constitution was to limit the power of the federal government in all things. It limited to very, very few things. They didn't want a government that could regulate the individual, that could spy on the individual, that could listen to their conversations. And certainly they did not want a government that was always going to war and that was taxing the people. In fact, there was no way under the original Constitution that the federal government could tax or monitor or control any individual. But all that has been forgotten because we don't teach the Constitution in our schools anymore or in our law schools. And there's a very good reason for it. And as Pastor Whitney begins to explore tonight, the various problems with the, I shouldn't say the problems, but the magnificent concepts laid out in the Bill of Rights, why I think you'll understand why there are people who hate the Constitution and are doing everything they can to limit and destroy it. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Blessing, Dr. Stan. Thank you for having me on your show, and I'm always gratified because I know your listeners are people who care about this country, and we're concerned about what's taking place and concerned that we have lost our way in a New World Order mess that is really stripping us of our God-given rights, the very thing that our founders feared the most, a government that would have no boundaries, a government that would see itself as omnipotent, basically, all-powerful and unrestrained and unrestricted. That's what they feared the most, and what they fought against, and what they bled and died for, what they paid an extremely high price for. Americans have had whittled away by inattention and by propaganda, where we've been lied to about the truths that our founders established in the Constitution and Declaration. And all of that can change if Americans get back to the original documents themselves and to the writings of our founders and rediscover this grand Christian constitutional republic that was established in order that every man would have the freedom and the security of his God-given rights given to him. As we look at the Bill of Rights, we see that our founders were not establishing something brand new at all. Rather, they were harking back to an Englishman's rights that were established all the way back in Magna Carta, on paper at least, for the first time, and then much later in 1689, the Englishman's Bill of Rights was also written down.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney from the Institute on the Constitution. Well, David, you were talking about the Magna Carta, you were talking about the English Bill of Rights, and go right ahead from there.
So our founders were not inventing something new. Basically, they were doing what their ancestors in England had done several different times, repeatedly, of reestablishing a Bill of Rights that told the government, this is what you cannot do because God has given us these rights. And the idea here is that government is really serving two masters. In a sense, government is serving God, and its duty to God is to secure the God-given rights of each of its citizens, and then government is also serving the citizens by securing those same set of God-given rights. And that's why most often in the olden days, you could say here in America, someone working for the government was truly a civil servant. Emphasis on that word servant. Today the idea of civil servant is almost a joke. It's like, I'm here from the government to help you. Everybody laughs. What do you mean? Nobody from the government is ever around to help you. And yet that was the idea of our founders, that government is to serve we the people. This week I'm running for office here in the state of Maryland for the House of Delegates, and there was a forum where there was sort of a debate taking place between all those running for the same office in our particular district. And I shared with the people in the audience that there are many promises being made here by those running for office of giving them all sorts of goodies and so on, but that's not really the purpose of government. We need to remember what George Washington said. I'm paraphrasing it, of course, but he said government is sort of like fire. Fire is a very, very useful tool when it's confined to the fireplace. It's safe there, and it can warm the room, and you can cook food on it and do many things when fire is confined in a structure like that. But let fire get out of the fireplace, and it'll burn down the whole house.
I think the exact words, fire is a dangerous servant, but a fearful master.
Yes, yes. And so that's the idea our founders had of government. It must be very strictly controlled and with an environment that's going to keep us safe from government. And so that structure that keeps us safe from government burning us is the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The Constitution, in one sense, you could see, as we studied the seven articles of the Constitution, it's the playing field in which our federal government is given enumerated and delegated powers from we the people to operate. So if you were to imagine a sports field, perhaps football.
Hold that thought for a moment, David, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution, talking about the Constitution and the idea that they were going to take the chains off the people, put the chains on the government so that men could be free. Go ahead, David.
So if we envision the idea that the Constitution itself, the seven articles, are a playing field, let's just, for the sake of the word picture, talk about a soccer field. Well, if you go on out to a soccer field, you know they put white line down all around there on the grass, and those white lines usually are some sort of powder lime or something like that that really aren't that long-lasting. And as they play the game, the referee says, oh, hey, you're out of bounds, and so on. Well, that's a pretty weak line of boundary around the playing field. In a sense, what the Bill of Rights does is it builds a very thick stone wall at the very edge of the field. So if any of the soccer players happen to kick the ball out of bounds, it cannot go out of bounds. It's because it's going to just bounce off the thick stone wall that's right there at the boundary of that playing field. That's what the Bill of Rights is designed to do. In other words, the Constitution itself, the seven articles, says this is what the federal government has delegated, limited authority to do. The Bill of Rights says this is what the federal government cannot and must not do. And so those four walls that compose the Bill of Rights, all 10 articles of the Bill of Rights, they protect us from intrusion of the federal government into areas that it has no business being involved in, areas in which it has no official jurisdiction. We the people, in our contract and our covenant with our federal government, never gave them permission to go outside the boundaries of that playing field. And that's the security that the Bill of Rights gives to us, which is why I think, as we discussed last month when we talked about the process of ratifying the Constitution, each state, each of the 13 states, had a debate going on, ratifying convention to discuss the merits as well as the demerits of the Constitution. And one of the glaring demerits that everyone spoke of was the lack of a Bill of Rights. And they knew this from their history, from the Magna Carta and Englishman's Bill of Rights. They knew that it was important, it was essential to protect yourself from a centralized government, such as the federal government that they were establishing by the Constitution. And so they brought together 12 amendments that ultimately were presented by Congress, and Congress sent these on to the states. In other words, Congress passed them, and three-quarters of the states ratified only the first 10 of these amendments, which we know as the Bill of Rights, and they ratified them, three-quarters of the states necessary ratified them by 1791, and the 11th amendment that was not ratified dealt with congressional reapportionment, never has been ratified. The 12th actually was ratified in 1993, which is pretty astonishing, and when we get to the 27th amendment, we'll look at what that 12th amendment that Madison had proposed actually says. Each of these first 10 amendments, we need to remember, it limits federal power. As we've studied beyond those 10 amendments, from the 11th through the 27th amendment, with few exceptions, we'll find that most of the succeeding amendments actually expand federal power. In other words, the first 10 amendments created this thick stone wall around the playing field that the constitutional powers were granted the federal government. The subsequent amendments undermined that wall, in some cases actually breached the wall and broke it down, leaving us, we the people, vulnerable to federal government expanding its power beyond that which our founders had designed for it. And that's why we have such a gargantuan, behemoth federal government in Washington, D.C. today. That's why we have intrusion into every area of your life. The federal government is concerned about the minutest details, ridiculous things like how much water you're permitted to flush down your toilet. Oh, who gave them the authority to decide how much water Americans can flush down their toilet? Certainly not we the people. We never gave them that authority. Yet they have taken and usurped that authority because they have broken out of the wall designed to contain them, and that wall is the Bill of Rights. So as we study the subsequent amendments, we'll make some interesting observations, I hope, regarding how some of these amendments very specifically violate the intent of our founders and violate the letter of what the Bill of Rights as well as the Constitution itself state. Nonetheless, they have become law. They can be unamended, as Prohibition was an example of one amendment that was undone, the 19th undone by the 21st. So it's not impossible to get rid of bad amendments, like when we talk about the 17th and so on, but it's not easy. Nonetheless, we have much to do to correct the mess that has been made of our structure and form of federal government. Well, let's talk about the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. And by the way, the order of these is important. The First Amendment is first because it's of highest importance and highest priority. It's the most important area of freedom to secure, and it's not to be taken lightly and somehow put in a different order. I was up at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, a museum devoted to the Constitution. We traveled up there for doing an edition of our magazine, Liberty Forum, just to interview and see and evaluate what they were teaching people about the Constitution, what they were teaching people about our foundation as a nation. And we were appalled by a lot of what was being communicated there. But one of the things that struck me is they have this little funny kind of cartoonish program about the Bill of Rights, all aimed at probably about a third grade level in terms of humor and that sort of thing. But they start the Bill of Rights as a countdown, 10, 9, 8, and they go all the way down. So they reverse the order that our founders established. And they established this order for a very specific reason, because religious liberty is the most important liberty of all. I remember a debate I had in classes years ago in college, but a debate about freedom, and people were saying, well, economic freedom is the most important. If you've got the economic freedom to work and all that, that's absolutely, and others know the freedom of speech and so on and so forth. And I said, raised my hand and said, you know, those freedoms are fine and good, but there is one freedom that precedes all of them, and essentially which all of them depend on, and that is the freedom of religion. If you do not have freedom of conscience, none of your other freedoms matter all that much at all, because if you are not free to think and believe as your conscience dictates and as God's law dictates, then you have been robbed of your most essential God-given freedom. And so the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, because religious liberty is absolutely essential to our concept of freedom and liberty altogether. This is a biblical concept, actually. They didn't come up with this idea on their own. You'll find in the Old Testament that kings always came from the tribe of Judah, and priests always came from the tribe of Levi. There was a sense of which the civil government and the religious government, or the church government, had separate jurisdictions, separate roles, separate functions within society, and those separations of functions and roles needed to be respected and honored. Jesus said himself in the New Testament, when he was questioned by a group of lawyers, actually the lawyers were trying to trap him and trick him, they thought, you know, if we can get Jesus to answer this way, we've got him trapped, or this way. They thought they had him completely trapped when they asked him the question, should we pay taxes to Caesar? Because after all, if he said, no, you shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar, the Romans would come and arrest him, and Jesus would be no problem to those religious leaders anymore. However, if he said the opposite, oh, yes, you ought to pay taxes to Caesar, well, then his popularity among the people in Jerusalem would plummet, and he wouldn't have any more followers. Jesus asked them, well, show me a coin. And they did. He said, whose image is on that coin? They replied, Caesar's. And then Jesus responded, render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Most often people ignore the second half of that statement, that we're to render to God the things that are God's. Well, that coin had the image of Caesar stamped upon it. What has the image of God stamped upon it? Every single human being conceived in this world has the image of God stamped upon them from the moment of conception. So Jesus is saying, you owe God everything you are, everything you have. You should worship and serve him and render your whole life to him as a living sacrifice. On the other hand, you also have duties that you owe to Caesar or to the civil government. Now, Jesus was saying, those duties, however, are limited. Never render to God, or never render to Caesar, the things that you owe to God. For example, later on, Christians were being thrown to the lions. What for? They refused to worship Caesar as a god. They refused to bow down and burn a pinch of incense and say, Caesar is Lord, that is, Caesar is God. Jesus said, you never render to Caesar that which belongs to God. However, you are to render to Caesar what belongs to him in his rightful jurisdiction. So Jesus was, again, drawing a distinction between the jurisdiction of civil government and the jurisdiction of the church government or religious government. And furthermore, the scripture clearly states throughout that civil government actually derives its authority from God. Read Daniel 2, where it talks about God raising up kings and deposing kings. Or read Romans 13, which is the most full exposition of the biblical theology of civil government. And it says there repeatedly, three times, that the civil magistrate is a minister of God. A minister of God. Imagine that. And what does a minister of God do? Does he administer laws that are contrary to God's law? No, he serves God, because that's what a minister of God does, serving God by administrating God's law in the land over which he is given a limited jurisdiction and a limited rulership. So all law is actually based upon moral values. You know, people get confused about this. They think law is just whatever we choose. No, it's someone's moral values being imposed. So when you hear someone say, you cannot legislate morality, they are demonstrating their ignorance, because every single law is a manifestation of someone's belief system, someone's morality, or you could say, someone's religion.
Well, you hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And of course, the Institute helps Radio Liberty and supports us, and we support them because we think what they're doing is so vitally important. Well, David, pick the story up there.
Well, when we go back in the history of our land and we look at the charters for each of the colonies, all 13 colonies received a charter, and every single one of them acknowledged God as the source of governmental authority. Even today, you pick up our Maryland State Constitution, and all 50 constitutions, you can find a similar sort of statement. Our Maryland Constitution begins grateful to Almighty God for our religious and civil liberties. So right in the beginning of our Constitution, in this state and most states, acknowledge that our rights come from God, not from government. And that's why it's so important that religious liberty be established as the bedrock upon which our nation was established.
You know, I think that's so amazing, David, because I don't think there's one person in 1,000 in America who realized that in every one of the constitutions of every one of the 50 states, there's an acknowledgement that the power and authority comes from God. So how could that possibly be correlated with the Supreme Court's decision that took God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools? And it can't be. The whole purpose was to target the minds of our youth and destroy their faith in God, knowing full well that if you destroy the faith of one generation, you could destroy the nation. And that's really what it's about, destroy the religious foundation of America, and you have destroyed America. Pick the story up there, please.
That's right, and as you mentioned, these people really are un-American. They are pursuing an agenda exactly contrary to what our founders established when they put together our Constitution and Bill of Rights. Well, if you look at the history of what took place leading up to the War for Independence, you'll see several significant things took place. First was a Great Awakening, a Christian revival in the 1740s, and that revival led many people to leave the established churches of their particular state. For example, the Church of England in particular lost a large number of people, and those people joined what are called dissenting churches, that is, churches who were not part of a state church system, such as the Presbyterians or the Methodists or the Baptists. And, of course, these people, as they left the state churches, they were very uncomfortable having to pay taxes to support that church that they had just left. Another example would be in the mix just before the War for Independence was James Madison and Patrick Henry, great heroes of our founding era. Both of them defended Baptists who were accused of preaching without receiving a license from the state of Virginia in that case. And this experience for both Madison and Patrick Henry, although they were Anglicans themselves, it led them to question the system that they had assumed was fine for many, many years. And it established in their mind a thinking that they needed to press forward for religious liberty in their own home state of Virginia. Then the big factor that is never spoken about in history books, but was very clearly an issue if you go back and read the writings of our founders and the letters that were being circulated, there was a grave concern on the part of Americans who were watching what was taking place in England and the Parliament and things that the king was stating. They heard that the king was threatening to install an archbishop over the colonies, that is, to bring religious conformity and to force the colonies to all be under the Church of England. Now, to us, that doesn't sound like such a bad thing. Well, what's the big deal, you know, just another religious hierarchy kind of thing. But we need to go back to that day and understand that if you oppose the state church system, you could be beaten for it. And Patrick Henry witnessed a man in Culpeper, Virginia, being beaten to death for refusing to take a license to preach the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. No religious liberty under that system of state church government.
Come right ahead, I guess. Of course, is Pastor David Whitney, and he's just talking about the fact that, you know, that originally all power dealing with religion was to be left with the states, and there was injustice in the states. But that was worked out at the state level, and they eventually modified their laws to become increasingly tolerant. But it was never up to the federal government in any way to have anything to do with the states. That was the decision of the people in the states, and they could either stay and fight it or move to another state. But never has anything to do with religion or power of religion to be given to the federal government, because they knew it would be misused. Go ahead.
And that's exactly what they saw in England, the misuse and abuse of that. And oddly enough, we think of archbishops in, you know, probably a pretty good light. In that day, they thought of archbishops with a bit of horror because they knew how someone was selected to be an archbishop. For example, the inventor of the thumb screw, that form of torture, you know what his reward was? He was assigned an archbishopric. Why? Because the job of the archbishop was to torture the dissenters and bring them into submission to the mother church, sort of thing. That was their job. They were, you know, the Inquisition of kind of the Anglican church. And so the colonists were horrified that even talk was being circulated in England about the idea of putting an archbishop, installing an archbishop over the colonies, because they knew that would suppress all the religious freedom that they were just beginning to enjoy. And so that, with that as the backdrop, we can understand why they abhorred the idea of a national religion that would be over all 13 states, and they didn't have a problem with each state, as you said, working out their own religious decisions and deciding whether to have an established church or not. That on the state level was fine, but they abhorred the idea on the national level because they saw the great damage it did and the loss of freedom from religious freedom in England, which is why the first people who came to the shores of this land came because of that exact reason. They were being persecuted and hounded by the state church in England. Now, when we come to the meeting, we've talked about this establishment clause. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Remember, it says Congress. It doesn't say the state of Massachusetts, the state of Virginia, or so forth. And we know that that's what was intended. It was only Congress, that is the federal government alone, that was being restricted, because 9 of the 13 states had established state church religions. So that, you know, you go to Massachusetts and the Congregational Church is a state church. Down in Virginia was the Episcopal Church, and so on. These states had state churches. They were not saying the states couldn't do this. They were not saying the states could not be involved in religiously making decisions based for their own states. But what's happened is a misinterpretation of the First Amendment, which we're going to look at here in a moment, has been carried to say that the states are also required in this phrase Congress, so they've basically eliminated and erased that word Congress. Instead of saying Congress shall make no law, they say any governmental agency on any level of government whatsoever shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or will not permit any practice of religion in any governmental scene or venue whatsoever. And that's really how they're interpreting the First Amendment today, which is a complete false interpretation. And we know that because they're requiring that the school board of a local community, so the school board of your county, they cannot allow the Bible, they cannot allow prayer, they cannot allow the Ten Commandments. Why? Oh, that would be to establish religion, which is a ridiculous idea. But nonetheless, they're saying nothing religiously can be done at any level of government whatsoever. Well, that's absolute historic ignorance. To make such a conclusion is to fly in the face of the history of our country, that up until it was in the 1830s that the last state-established church was ended.
I think it was really so interesting that the Supreme Court held that the Ten Commandments could not be posted in a public place, or certainly in a schoolroom, because it wouldn't do any good to have them posted unless the children read them. And, of course, if they read them, why, they might meditate upon them. If they meditated upon them, they might obey them. And if they were to obey the Ten Commandments, that would be a direct violation of the wall of separation between church and state. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the decision of the United States Supreme Court in 1980. And, of course, then we ask, gee, I wonder why there's so much violence in the schools today. I wonder why children are killing children, and children are killing teachers, and, oh, shucks, but, ladies and gentlemen, what we need is not more federal legislation. What we need is a return of the moral teachings of the Bible. And what we need are men who fear God in the Supreme Court and in government positions. Not the people who are there intentionally to destroy the moral foundation of this once great Christian nation, and ultimately to destroy the nation. We're going to be back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney, and David, go right along.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the phrase, the wall of separation between church and state, because that has been the phrase used to destroy the original intent and meaning of the First Amendment. You know, that phrase, wall of separation between church and state, occurs nowhere at all in the Constitution or in the Bill of Rights or in any of the subsequent amendments. It was actually penned by Thomas Jefferson in a letter he wrote in 1803 to Danbury Baptist, which is 14 years after the First Amendment was adopted. And furthermore, Jefferson, he was not even in the country when the First Amendment was adopted. He was representing us in France as an ambassador. And Jefferson's words were in the context of his letter, basically stating this, if I were to summarize his letter. He was promising the Baptists in Danbury, who were in a church-state system. In other words, in Connecticut, the Congregationalist Church was the established church of that state, and that meant their taxes went to pay to support the Congregationalist Church, even though they were Baptist, and they didn't use the Congregationalist Church. And they were afraid that Thomas Jefferson and some others in his administration were going to impose strict controls or invasion into their religious liberty, which, you know, was a little bit tenuous in some respects there in Connecticut. Thomas Jefferson wrote back to them and said, "My friends, do not worry at all, because there is a wall that prevents us, the federal government, from doing anything to interfere with your religious liberty." Now, that's a different story in terms of your state government, but in terms of the federal government, we have no constitutional power in any way, shape, or form to get involved in your church. It's impossible for us to do so. And so this phrase, wall of separation, was used to express a prohibition against the federal government doing anything. In other words, the image here of a wall, which is the Bill of Rights, around the constitutional powers preventing the federal government from doing anything to interfere with the religious liberty of any individual citizen. Now, there is several times the Supreme Court has referenced Thomas Jefferson's letter. Every time, up until 1947, that they referenced Jefferson's letter, they included the entire text of the letter in the Supreme Court opinion. So they were talking about the phrase in its context. They were talking about the intent of the entire letter.
Now, David, I'm going to interfere with you there, but ask you to just hold that thought for just a moment as we reach out across America to bring back all of our various stations into the Radio Liberty Network. So we'll be back in just a moment, and I really want to explore that. It's such an important issue. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Pastor David Whitney was just mentioning this concept of the wall of separation between church and state, which really came from a letter that Thomas Jefferson had written to the Baptist ministers in Danbury, Connecticut, stating that they did not need to be concerned that he or anybody else in the federal government was going to interfere with their religious liberty, because there was a wall of separation between church and state. In other words, the federal government could have no say or no influence on what the state government did. And David was just saying that, you know, there had been a number of instances through the years that where the Supreme Court had dealt with and actually quoted from that letter. But they quoted the whole letter. Oh, not so in the 1940s, when they wanted to destroy the religious foundation of this country. They just took one little phrase out, in other words, one phrase out of context, to change the entire meaning of what Thomas Jefferson had said. So you pick up the story there, David.
Yes, so basically you could say the Supreme Court in 1947 lied about what Jefferson's phrase meant. They hijacked his phrase, wall of separation between church and state, twisted it around to mean something he never intended it to mean, and began to use it to break down the wall that our First Amendment gave us as a protection against the federal government's interference in our religious freedoms. And then they marched forward year after year until, as you mentioned, 1980, finally tearing down the Ten Commandments, and prayer is out, the Bible is out of schools and out of the public square altogether. Chief Justice Roy Moore down there in Alabama set up a Ten Commandments monument in the rotunda of the Supreme Court, and then he has the federal government coming after him saying, "You can't do that, even though you're the chief judicial officer of the state of Alabama, elected by the people of Alabama. You can't have the Ten Commandments. Why? Well, there is a separation of church and state. So this lie has been used to basically try to exclude Christianity and biblical concepts and principles from every single potential public place. Basically, their drive is to drive Christians back into their church walls and not even be able to witness on the streets or proclaim the gospel on the streets or pass out tracts in some cities. That this is an anti-Christian move by those who want to eliminate Christianity from our culture.
And I just in a matter of commenting on Judge Roy Moore, actually the federal government rewarded the state attorney general, who had actually was the one who brought charges and prosecuted Judge Roy Moore. And they actually rewarded him by giving him an interim appointment to the federal bench. In other words, the Senate would not actually ratify him. So our present Christian administration rewarded the man who destroyed the career of Judge Roy Moore by giving him an interim appointment to the federal bench. There's not one probably in 1,000 Christians that knows that. I mean, we honestly believe that the people in Washington, D.C. and the Republican Party are representing Christian values, whereas exactly the opposite is the case. In fact, there's a new book that just came out the last couple of days, written by the man who headed the faith-based section in the White House, who says that, you know, when the Christians aren't there, they call them nuts and wackos and crazies. That is the way that the leaders, the current Christian administration, refer to this as a man. I think the gentleman's name is Mr. Kuo, K-U-O. And he's come out with a new book, only been on the market for a few days. But the attitude is just to laugh at how ridiculous the Christians are. But they're using them, and they're using them very effectively to support the current administration. So pick up the story there, David.
So that is the false interpretation of the First Amendment, that somehow there is no possibility for Christianity, Christian values, Christian beliefs, Christian law, basically, to influence government. I mean, that idea is so ludicrous from our founders' point of view, because the laws of nature and nature's God were Christian concepts of Christian law based upon the Bible. You had to have the Bible influence every single piece of legislation if that legislation was going to be actually legitimate. If you made a piece of legislation that violated the laws of nature and nature's God, in other words, the law of God given to us in the Bible, that piece of legislation was garbage and should be put through the shredder. It was absolutely worthless. So the idea that we've been sold today, and sadly, many Christians have bought this and many pastors have bought this, that we as Christians, we're just in a secular society, we really cannot and should not. I've had Christians tell me we should not influence what takes place on our state or federal level of government or the legislation that takes place, that we ought to be hands-off, just let the pagans take control of all of that and let them have their way because it's not our job, it's not our calling in Christ. You know, all of that is a complete opposite of not only our founders but of the men who wrote God's holy word, the Bible. God's law is absolute. It does not change, and man must submit to God's law or be punished by the disobedience against God's law. The actual interpretation of the words of the First Amendment are not hard to find. Madison explained on the floor of Congress in 1789, and this is recorded in Floyd's summary of those debates on the floor of Congress. It said this, he quotes, Mr. Madison said, he apprehended the meaning of the words, that is of the First Amendment, the meaning of the words that Congress should not establish a religion and enforce the legal observation of it by law, nor compel men to worship God in any manner contrary to their conscience. Again, notice he's saying this is a restriction on Congress and on Congress alone, that Congress does not have the freedom or the power to do that. Well, a few years later, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Joseph Story, he wrote a commentaries on the Constitution. Now, here's a man that's close enough to the founders to have had discussions with them. Here's an expert in our Constitution who understood it thoroughly, and he was a Supreme Court justice. And in his book, Commentaries on the Constitution in 1833, he wrote this, probably at the time of the adoption of the Constitution and of the amendment to it now under consideration, which was the First Amendment in his text, the general, if not the universal sentiment was that Christianity ought to receive encouragement from the state, so far as was not incompatible with the private right of conscience and the freedom of religious worship. Let me pause there in this quotation, because here's a very important thing. He's saying that instead of inhibiting Christianity, Christianity should be encouraged by the state. Why would he say such a thing? For most people today, they say, that's crazy. That's an idea that we can't live with. Well, our founders knew that if you're going to have government that is limited, it's going to take people who have self-government. That is, they choose to obey the law of God themselves. You don't have to have a policeman watching them every second of every day to see that they don't steal something in the shopping center or they don't murder somebody in the back alley. If you have a person who's self-governed because they're a Christian, they believe the law of God is right, they want to follow what is right in their life, they're self-motivated to obey God's law, then you can have true liberty in a country. But if you have a country with a bunch of murderers running around killing each other, what, the only way there's security is if everybody, you know, has this police force that's powerful enough to watch every single person's movement. And that's what we're being told today is, well, we've got to have all these spy cameras watching your every movement because we can't trust any one of you. You're all a bunch of murderers. You're all a bunch of terrorists or whatever. That's what we're being sold, that idea that surveillance of every moment of every day of our lives is necessary because we're all unsafe people to permit outside of any sort of control like that. Our founder said, no, the opposite should be the case. And it only is the case when you have a moral and religious people, a people who obey God's law from the heart because they want to. And that's why Christianity should be encouraged by government, not discouraged or hindered. He continued in his commentaries on the Constitution, Joseph Story said, any attempt to level all religions and to make it a matter of state policy to hold all in utter indifference would have created universal disapprobation, that is, disapproval, if not universal indignation. The real object of the First Amendment was not to countenance, much less to advance Mohammedanism, which is their phrase for Islam, or Judaism, or infidelity, in other words, atheism or agnosticism, not to advance any of those by prostrating Christianity, but its purpose was to exclude all rivalry among Christian sects and to prevent any national ecclesiastical establishment which should give to a hierarchy the exclusive patronage of the national government. Notice the astonishing thing he is saying there, contrasted with our president today, who says, all Muslims are just as good as Americans as anybody else, or, you know.
We all pray to the same God. I love that phrase. I mean, of course, the Muslims, of course, pray to the moon god. That's why their symbol is the crescent moon. You would think that the president would realize that they have an entirely different god, but go ahead.
And if you allow, as England is discovering in France to their chagrin, if you allow Muslims to advance their faith, they have an agenda. If they're going to follow the Quran, their agenda is to take over the entire society and change the legal system of that society, forcing Muslim law, Quranic law, upon every single citizen, even if they're not Muslims. They have an agenda.
And let me just point out that in Iraq today, most Americans don't realize, but our boys are over there fighting for the new Iraqi constitution and democracy. And the new Iraqi constitution establishes a state with Sharia law, and all laws are to go right along with the religious laws of the Muslim, of the Islamic, of the Shia faith, and they've established basically a socialist or totalitarian Shia government, and that's what we're fighting to keep over there. But I wonder how many Americans have actually read the Iraqi constitution, because most people would be incensed to find out that we had changed the country from a secular society under a corrupt dictator to a Muslim Islamic country to another corrupt dictator. It really doesn't matter, you know, what happened before. At least Christians could practice their faith. There were about 10% of the population were Christians. Today, about 3% of the population are Christians. Most of the Christians have fled, and the rest of them will as soon as they're able to, because they don't want to live in an Islamic country, and that is what we brought to Iraq with the blood of American soldiers.
Tragic. And you know, those Christians recognize what most Americans don't, that you cannot have freedom, you cannot have true liberty for anyone unless you have Christianity at the foundation of the law of that nation.
Amen to that.
You have Islam, no freedom for anyone except those who are followers of the idol Allah. You worship Buddhists and allow Buddhists to control the law, you will not have freedom for anyone but Buddhists. And Hindus, the same thing for any religious system. Most people have bought this lie, and it is a flat-out lie, that you can have morally and religiously neutral legislation, that laws can somehow have no religious implication or religious taint to them whatsoever. That's a lie. And matter of fact, the people selling that lie are atheistic secular humanists, which is a religion. And they're selling their religion of atheism and trying to shove it down the throat of every poor child that's subjected to the government school systems these days. But notice what Joseph Story says, that the object of the First Amendment was not to advance any of these other religions, but rather Christianity was to receive encouragement from the state. The only thing it was saying is that there would be no national church, not like England that had the Church of England, not like other countries that had a state church that was over all of that country, over all of that nation. Instead, nationally, there would be no state-established church, but in each individual state, they could have an established church. This idea, for many Americans, is very hard to understand because they've heard the lies so frequently and so long, and they've come to believe it, and their religious leaders, their pastors and priests and rabbis have all spouted these same lies. And how in the world was that accomplished? We see the First Amendment protects every true church in America. The problem is, churches were sold a bill of goods with a 501c3 and incorporation. They were sold the lie that they could be protected from lawsuits and other things, and that they would have greater donations, which is a temptation for any pastor to say, oh, you're going to have more money coming into the coffers if you become a 501c3. What they didn't realize is what they were being sold is a complete surrender of their First Amendment rights. Because if they're incorporated, they're no longer a church. They're an incorporation. If they become a 501c3, the IRS says they're no longer really a church. They're a not-for-profit religious organization, not a church. A church is a truly free church is one that is free from government interference, a church protected by the First Amendment where the federal government cannot interfere in the functions of that church. But as soon as a church accepts a 501c3 or becomes incorporated, they accept federal government regulation of even what is preached from the pulpit. Now, they don't tell the people that, the pastors that when they accept the 501c3 that the IRS basically says, if you accept this, you cannot influence or hinder not only any candidate for office, that is, you can't say, vote for Joe Schmo or don't vote for Joe Schmo, but also you cannot advance or inhibit any piece of legislation whatsoever because it's considered lobbying, and you cannot do any lobbying if you were a non-profit religious organization, 501c3, or if you were incorporated. In other words, the churches that used to practice active involvement in what was taking place politically in their community were suddenly gagged and silenced, strangely silenced, in the history, if you study the history of our country, for 150-plus years. Pastors regularly were called upon to preach Election Day sermons, and these sermons were telling the people, as they were preparing to go to the polls, the kind of character and the kind of people they ought to be electing to office. Pastors were telling people what sort of a person to choose for governor, to choose for congressman. They were telling them the character that these people ought to have. Therefore, when people said Bill Clinton's a liar and he's an adulterer and all this, that Election Day sermons would preach that kind of stuff and say, don't vote for such a wicked man. He is not to be trusted with the tremendous power that his office entails. In addition, not only were Election Day sermons preached, once a legislature was elected, one of their first duties was the governor of the state or the president would call a pastor to preach a sermon to those who had been elected to office. And the sermon they were to preach about their God-given duties as ministers of God, what they were supposed to do, how they were to apply the law of God, this was the kind of power that the Church of Jesus Christ had in those days. It proclaimed God's truth to the civil magistrate. because the civil magistrate could only function and accomplish its job if it understood what God's law said its job was.
David, we're just about out of time. I want you to get out your telephone number. I want you to get out the website for the Institute of the Constitution.
Our telephone number is a toll-free number. It's 866-730-9796. That toll-free number again is 866-730-9796. And our website, you can actually go to the website and order our host kit so you can communicate these truths to others. Our website is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com.
And let me tell our listeners, it's so vitally important that you get this information, that you begin utilizing it, and it's all there. Actually, all the lectures are on video. All you have to do is present them. You've got to begin to educate people. You've got to tell them about the wonderful history of our Constitution, the truth that's been repressed. Thank you so much, David.
God bless you, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And David, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
All right, fine. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, if people understood the dramatic change that has taken place in our land, there's a number of factors that have contributed to it. Part of it is churches accepting 501c3, which means they have backed away from actually being the prophetic voice that our founders expected the churches to be. John Adams said, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate to the governance of any other. And by religious, he didn't mean just any religion, like Muslim or Buddhist. No, he meant Christianity in all of its orthodox branches. He was saying, if you don't have Christian people who are following the moral commands of Jesus Christ, moral and religious people, our Constitution won't work. It can't work, because it's designed for people to have self-government following God's law from their own heart. And if we don't have people doing that, there's no amount of human power that we've designed in this system that will permit it. The only thing that works for people who will not follow God's law is a despotic tyrant who will control every aspect of their life. And that's not what they designed this form of government to do, but John Adams admitted it. He said it won't work. It will only work if they're Christians. And that's why, for ages, our government actually encouraged Christianity. Somebody like Thomas Jefferson, who I'd never believe is actually became an Orthodox Christian. He believed in many of the teachings of Jesus and so on. But when he was president, he used taxpayers' dollars. He signed a bill that taxpayers' dollars would be used to hire missionaries to take the gospel of Jesus Christ to American Indians out in the West. Well, people would be horrified. You know, that would be, people just couldn't believe. Thomas Jefferson did? Yes, he did. Look at the historical records. He did that because he understood if we're going to have peace with the Indians and if we're going to advance our country, it's only going to come as they become Christians and can participate in a form of government that we have. So our government over the history of time has actually advanced Christianity and supported Christianity because that was essential to the functioning of our government. Today, the opposite is taking place. As you've already mentioned, they're advancing atheistic secular humanism, anti-Christian bigotry, and anti-Christian law in order to change our form of government. And that's what's happening. And it's tragic as a pastor to see that churches have basically been co-opted and given up their birthright, really, for a mess of pottage from Caesar. And that mess of pottage, a 501c3, an incorporation, they're garbage that are not even worth it.
David, we're out of time. God bless. Thanks
God bless
very
you.
Much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you all enjoyed our regular session, a monthly session with Pastor David Whitney. Let me mention, we carry certain things. We carry something called the Freedom Documents. Was put together by a good friend, Pastor Chuck Baldwin. It's
the 50
major documents upon which this country is based, from the Declaration of Independence to George Washington's farewell address to the Gettysburg Address to the Mayflower Compact to all of the documents that you need to have at your fingertips. And they're all together in one volume. It's called the Freedom Documents. It's available from Radio Liberty. We carry Bill Federer's wonderful book, America's God and Country, and you can get that by book form or on CD. And then, of course, we have John Stormer's excellent book, the trade by the bits. I also like to mention, if you had not heard, that we're fighting to establish a government over in Iraq under Sharia law, under Muslim law. What was a secular government before is now a religious government, a radical Muslim government. Why, we have a tape interview with with John Stormer, where he tells the story, because he's read the Iraqi Constitution, and they're doing everything they can to conceal that fact. I mean, why would American boys be over there dying to establish a radical Muslim nation with a constitution that brings everything under Sharia law? Well, we also carry John Stormer's book, Betrayed by the Bench, certainly Phyllis Schlafly's The Supremacist, and I think one of the most important books that I have is entitled Original Intent. It was written by David Barton, and it has certainly the wonderful quotations from our founding fathers. So let me once again mention the books. Of course, there'd be the founding documents, America's God and Country by William Federer, Betrayed by the Bench by John Stormer, and The Supremacist by Phyllis Schlafly, and then Original Intent by David Barton. Now, this is the time when I really need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is putting on an all-day seminar the last Monday of this month. That's October 29th, and it's going to be the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. We're bringing in speakers from Michigan and Southern California, and Constance Company will be here, one of my favorite guests, and as well as Chris Pinto, who produced the award-winning documentary The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. We've got a great line of speakers, and we hope you can come. Now, it'll be all day long. We're serving lunch. You're going to have reservations, and we're going to have to decide this week, because this coming week, and of course, if you want to send a check, you've got to get that check off right away, because but let us know if you're going to be here coming, and make a reservation now. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. I think you'll really enjoy the lineup of speakers that we have, and there'll be so much information there, other information that you'll have access to, that you really need for times like these. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will be sure to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you want to understand the spiritual component of what's going on, why, you can get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. There are three of them, all three those pamphlets together, one, part one, part two, part three. We carry a book called Hostage to the Devil. It was written by Malachi Martin, who I had the privilege of knowing when he was alive. And of course, we have a four-tape set of my interviews with him, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, which we suggest maybe you get both of them together in the Malachi Martin special. We have such books as The Diary of a Devil Hunter, a gentleman who was into the satanic movement and got out and goes all over the country giving lectures to the police. And then the FBI comes in and says, don't listen to him. There are no satanic movement in America, despite the fact that the Son of Sam killer was part of a satanic cult. And most of the people involved in the Son of Sam killings are still free. Charles Manson was a disciple of Anton LaVey and part of the same religious sect as David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam killer. You need to have this information. You need to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but please do not call in unless we specifically ask for telephone calls, and actually we seldom do that when we have the next guest. It's Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and certainly one of the most insightful analysts of what's going on in the country today. Joel, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Well, it's my pleasure, Dr. Stan. Good to be with you.
All right, fine. Well, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Well, I think we ought to address David Kuo's book on tempting faith.
Oh, I'm so glad you got to cover that. I think that it's so important that Christians understand that they're laughing at us back there in the White House.
Yes, he says some of the nation's most prominent evangelical leaders are known in the office of Karl Rove as, quote, the nuts. Christian leaders, you know, were prayed with by the president, received hugs and smiles in person, but were dismissed behind their backs and described as, quote, ridiculous, out of control, or just plain goofy. You know, these are serious allegations. It means that, frankly, that the White House has been using the Christian evangelical movement for political support, and when they are despised behind their back.
And I thought it was so interesting, and we just heard on the news that that Karl Rove says it just isn't true. It just isn't true. You can trust me. It isn't true. And what would you expect him to say? Of course we call them nuts and kooks, you know, behind their backs. And I do not believe Karl Rove is an honorable man at all. And I do not feel very comfortable having him as one of the key advisors to the President of the United States.
Well, one of the things that bothers me is all of the insiders that have come out of the White House and honest enough to say what's really going on indicate that the use of the F word among the president and all his advisors is just rampant. I mean, this is an evil and amoral administration that simply doesn't have any respect for the Lord's name, for proper language. And this is typical. It was typical of Richard Nixon, even, when you get the tape recordings of his conversations. I mean, these people are just not moral individuals, no matter what they put across. And I think Ronald Reagan was an exception. I think there was a very fine individual who, as we know, you know, never was intended by the establishment to make it to the presidency. And when he did, they compromised him by forcing upon him George Bush as a vice president, and they had control over White House personnel as well. But this is, you know, when David quotes these people like Karl Rove using the F word, refusing to the faith, or referring to the faith-based initiatives, you know there's no respect for it. You know he's lying. A person who uses that kind of language really can't be trusted not to lie anyway. When they pretend to be something that they aren't, that's a lie in and of itself. So I'm glad this book has come out. It has confirmed what I've been saying in the World Affairs Brief for many years.
Well, of course, we have actually references to articles written when George W. was the governor of the state of Texas. He used the F word all the time. And yet, of course, before the Christians, he smiles and tells how he looks to God all the time. Well, I will tell you that when you're a Christian, I don't think you can use those words routinely. You might, you know, there's no excuse for that. And I think it reflects on, well, a person's faith. If they're really transformed, if they're really born again, they're not going to be using such vulgar and crude language in private.
Absolutely,
and
I agree.
You should never be willing to say something in private that you're not willing to say in public. Well, Joel, go right ahead.
Well, the top story in the World Affairs Brief today is the big lie, Bush getting tough on North Korea. And I know, I hope this is a different audience than when we spoke before.
It's entirely different.
Yes. But, you know, in the wake of North Korea's purported underground test, it's still unclear whether Pyongyang really is bluffing or not. As defense analyst Michael Evans said, there's still no definitive proof that a nuclear device has been detonated at the tunnel facility in northeast North Korea. For a nuclear test, one would have expected some radioactivity to be released into the atmosphere, he says. But actually, I disagree with that. Given the small size of this blast, and that's one of the problems, the small size indicates it probably didn't go as expected, or it may have been even a decoy, meaning that it was simply a large batch of conventional explosive meant to produce an effect that could be read by seismographs in the area. The sniffing aircraft that the U.S. sends out to see if there's any residual radiation was not able to find any. It came back, and its results were given today. But in essence, it really doesn't matter whether they've done it or not. The point is North Korea's continued nuclear saber-rattling is specifically aimed at showcasing the hypocrisy of U.S. foreign policy. Kim Jong-il is out to show the world that the U.S., that he's going to flaunt his nuclear weapons. The U.S. isn't going to do anything to them, to him. You're going to, you know, pontificate. They're going to threaten and cajole, but there won't be anything being done. And he's setting up the United States to look extremely bad when they attack Iran, because Iran, there's no proof that they have a nuclear program. Now, I'm convinced that they are attempting to. If I knew that the evil empire was aiming at attacking you, I'd be trying the best I could to develop any kind of weapon to defend yourself against it. And while I'm certainly not saying that the Iranian regime is the paragon of human rights, it's certainly not as bad as Saddam Hussein was in terms of the life of people there, even though it's, you know, has a great deal of religious intolerance, being a Muslim fundamentalist country. Nevertheless, you know, there just isn't a reason to be attacking and destroying a country under the present circumstances. But I think what the United States is really aiming at, and that's one of the reasons why they're being so vociferous in their protestations about this, is that they know as well that it's making the United States look bad.
All right, hold on. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Joel. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel was just saying that all of this fuss about the Koreans, North Koreans, and Kim Sung-il actually supposedly setting off a nuclear device is really to show the hypocrisy of the United States. On one hand, they will not do anything about what we presume to be a nuclear North Korea, and yet, of course, we're going to attack Iran because they may be trying to develop a nuclear weapon, but even the CIA has said it'll be at least between 5 and 10 years before they have one. So on one hand, we're just really not that concerned about North Korea, which has presumably nuclear weapons, but we're very concerned about Iran that may develop them sometime in the future, which shows that our coming war and the coming attack on Iran has nothing to do with nuclear weapons or rogue states getting them. There seems to be another agenda. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, I think so, Dr. Stan. You know, there's a lot that could be going on. One of the largest pieces of deception in this whole movement is that Russia and China are allies in trying to get North Korea to disband its nuclear program. It's just an out-and-out lie. They're covering for it. This is one of their surrogates. It is my feeling as well that the entire nuclear show that North Korea is putting on, or playing like they're putting on, really is just so much of a ruse. I believe that North Korea has, of course, a well-developed missile program, which is well-known. I think it's just as likely that Russia and China have provided nuclear weapons to mount on those missiles when the time is right for North Korea. I don't think North Korea has had to develop their own nuclear program at all, being a surrogate state of China and Russia. So it's really impossible to tell, except we always know from history that the communists have lied, have used a great deal of deception, to play like they are weak or that they're developing something when in fact it's already fully developed. So I expect the worst out of the communists. I know that they're attempting to build for a future preemptive strike against the West. I think they view all of the U.S. Intervention in the Middle East as a fortuitous help to them to justify their future strike on America. America is quickly gaining itself a reputation as the bully of the world, and I think at some point there will be a massive retaliation based upon our extreme intervention in the Middle East, and it certainly isn't for the reason of democracy. Now, you know, as you pointed out on your program many times, and I pointed out in the World Affairs Brief, the globalists who, or the insiders, the powers that be, however you refer to them, you know, we don't know many of the names of those who are really running this massive conspiracy against liberty in America. We know a lot of the second-level people who direct the show and are handlers of the president, but we really don't know the powerful people behind the scenes, so we have to use acronyms like the insiders. We know they're there. We know that a person like George Bush is not running the show. He's not making the decisions. He's simply not intelligent enough. He doesn't have the background. He can't even speak clearly. So it's very obvious this man is a script reader, and he's not running the show. It's one of the most, in fact, one of the most disappointing things about David Kuo's book was the fact that he continues to praise the president as a sincere, honest Christian. Anyone who knows as much about the four-letter words and the bad-mouthing of the Christians in the White House certainly would know about Bush's constant foul language in the White House and his relative playing the same game that Karl Rove was playing. So I'm a little bit disappointed there. He seems to be covering his tracks to make sure that he has it in with the very people he's telling you're being made fools of. He is owing, because he's part of the fundamentalist Christian movement, wants to maintain his relationship, and he knows that if he bashes President Bush, that they'll cut him off. These people in the high-powered Christian movement are relatively ruthless in their attacking of anyone who's critical of George Bush. They simply won't tolerate it. And one of the reasons is they've gone on record in public, on television, in their sermons, dozens of times, praising this president. And it's very difficult for these people who supposedly represent this version of the Lord to backtrack and say we were wrong. And very few of them seem to be man enough to do that.
Not only that, but with the faith-based initiative out there and millions of dollars are being given as gifts to Christian ministries across America, there's the old adage that the he who pays the piper calls the tune. And I really feel very, very strongly that no Christian ministry should ever take money from the federal government, no matter how altruistic it may sound, with a name like faith-based initiatives. But some of these ministries are getting $1 or $2 million, and you really wonder how objective they can be in being critical of an administration that gives them that sort of money.
And it's a violation of basic Christian principles, too. This money is taken by government theft from people's productive taxes, and none of that money, in principle, should ever be used, even for charitable purposes. We don't rob Peter to pay Paul for charitable purposes. That's not the way that Christ does things. It should be voluntary giving alone. And so by dipping into the forced government extraction of money policy, even if it's to fund faith-based initiatives, is not justified in my rule book of principles as I read how things should properly be done. But returning to the Korea question, you know, the U.S., this is not the first time that the U.S. has given ultimatums to North Korea. This thing started clear back in 1994 with the agreed framework, an international consortium established by the Bush administration. And there were millions of dollars that were funded to Bechtel and other peoples to build a couple of nuclear reactors to North Korea. This was supposed to be an exchange for North Korea ceasing their nuclear program. Clear back in 1994, Dr. Stan. And here we are. They've still been cheating. And the U.S. is talking about doing a new agreement with them with appropriate incentives. I mean, what's different than 1994? They had all the incentives, all the food aid, two nuclear reactors, millions of dollars in oil, in fuel oil to be shipped to North Korea in order to pay for their deficit in energy production and energy usage. But all of that came to naught, and in fact, at the time that it was being discussed that there was a massive violation, the U.S. had put on hold. This was, clear back in 2002. Mind you, this is, eight years after the 1994 agreed framework. It was very well known that North Korea was cheating. There was much intelligence about activity going on in the nuclear industry and in the weapons and missile proliferation industry. And the president announced to the nation that it was in the, quote, vital interest of the national, vital national security interest of the United States that he release the $95 million to North Korea as part of the agreed framework to replace the country's own nuclear power. Now, that $95 million, most of that was still going to Bechtel to finish those nuclear power plants. But still, a good portion of that was being siphoned off directly to the leadership of North Korea. Even though the food aid, for example, was being used by the North Koreans to parcel out to people on condition that they joined the Communist Party. In other words, there was a condition attached to receiving food aid. The U.S. continued to give that food aid and allow the communist government to use it to twist arms to join the communist movement. So the Bush administration, as well as the Clinton administration, were co-partners in being extremely permissive with North Korea. Why should we be surprised that North Korea continues to cheat? And now we're talking about the same thing. The president reiterated time and again in his latest news conference that he was going to work diplomatically with North Korea. And the press had a field day. Even the White House press, who is very much scripted, who can't dare criticize the president openly or call him a hypocrite, began to take him apart on the on this issue. One of them talked about, well, what about the red line, sir? Clear back in 2003, you said, and I'm quoting a journalist in the White House press corps, you effectively drew a line in the sand. You said, we will not tolerate a nuclear Korea. That was in 2003. Yet now it appears they've crossed that line. Bush responds, no, I appreciate that. And I think it's very important for the American people and North Korea to understand that that statement still stands. Really? So when do the consequences happen? If that statement still stands, we will not tolerate North Korea. They're now a nuclear nation, or at least they claim to be. So if not now, when are you going to divvy out some consequences to them? So, as another follow-up question, the press said, you spoke passionately before about acting before it was too late on major issues. You faced one of those moments in early 2003. This was when the North Koreans had thrown out the international inspectors. They said they were going ahead and starting to turn fuel into weapons, and you did nothing in 2003. And he said, you mean I should have bombed them? The question, yes, and you chose not to. And I was wondering whether, in retrospect, said the journalist, you regret that decision now, whether or not you think, because of the long history of deception that you pointed out before, you should have acted differently. Bush evades the question, says, I used the moment to continue my desire to convince others to become equity partners in the Korean issue. Because I believe, I obviously looked at all the options all the time, and I felt the best way to solve this problem was through diplomacy. Now, that's not the message he's giving with Iran. With Iran, he's saying, with Iraq, he was saying, everyone was saying, we need to have more diplomacy. The inspectors aren't finding weapons there. And Bush said, no, we've got to move into military action. Now, when military action is the only thing that everybody knows will help the Korean, the president is saying, no, diplomacy.
Well, of course, would you really want him to use military action on Korea?
No, of course.
Yes, I mean, you wouldn't really want, but you're just pointing out that how inconsistent.
I'm pointing out the hypocrisy of the situation. I'm pointing out that there's a dual agenda here.
Absolutely. And, of course, so much of this, I think, is just to placate the American people. I think they play games with our minds, and anybody who's ever studied the history of going back to 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, will find out that, we finance Russia and Communist China and Communist countries throughout the world during most of the 20th century.
And we gave them nuclear weapons.
Right. All right, go ahead, Joel.
So this has been going on a long time. That is, the financing of communism, the selling out of Western interests when they are in contention, military contention with communists. We have to remember that in 1947 we betrayed Chiang Kai-shek by cutting off arms. We allowed Mao Zedong to take power over all of China. Even before World War II was through, what the Russians could not steal from our Manhattan Project on nuclear plans, the White House, the Roosevelt White House, shipped to via this air base in Montana. And Major Jordan was one who kept a diary of these things. He was the customs officer there, and he found these plans, and he called the White House and said, there are suitcases there that I've opened, sealed diplomatic suitcases that have nuclear weapons plans, and they're going to Russia. And the White House told him, you're to let it proceed. So he even interdicted that shipment, and the Roosevelt White House demanded that he let it proceed. So
that story is told in a book called From Major Jordan's Diary. That's from Major Jordan's Diary. A very
And you carry that book, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, no, we don't. It's out of print. But
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well, I have quoted excerpts from Major Jordan's diary. It's a dramatic revelation. But we find as well that we also gave them their first supplies of nuclear-enriched uranium to build their first bomb. We were building the best enemy that money can buy, quoting Dr. Stanley Monteith.
Well, that's quoting Professor Sutton, but we certainly have a video by that name, my interview with him, but go ahead.
Yes. So it's no surprise that the Bush administration gave this money to North Korea, even knowing that North Korea was going to continue to cheat. But Kim Jong-il seems to be wanting to just stick it in, the knife further in and twist it and make the U.S. look bad. And certainly he's doing a very good job at that. What's interesting as well is we have so much deception going on in the U.N. Security Council right now, trying to come out with a revolution to condemn North Korea. And I found out today that there is a fair amount of a backtracking going on. It's not going to be, as the president said at his news conference, a resounding statement of unified voices against North Korea. China and Russia are balking as we speak at the new draft resolution in the United Nations, the one that's being circulated by the U.S. that would prohibit countries from sending military and luxury goods to North Korea, as well as industrial items that might be used for weapons. Russia and China are balking at that because obviously they will continue to export those items to North Korea. Interestingly enough, the language in an earlier draft demanding a freezing of North Korean assets related to counterfeiting, money laundering, and narcotics was also dropped. So what else is left? If you don't have any prohibitions against weapons programs, transfers of weapon material, you don't have any, and you don't freeze their assets, and you don't stop them from using the port facilities in other Western nations, what else is left of the sanctions? These sanctions aren't even as tough as what they're proposing for Iran. And yet here's a country who's claiming to have a nuclear weapons program.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, basically I think that China is a communist, certainly a client state of communist China. Korea is a client state of communist China, and nobody wants to say that.
Well, the Western media and the
Hold that
Koreans.
Thought.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we're just commenting that, you know, North Korea is a client state of communist China and probably of Russia as well. The two of them are working together, and all the time, of course, we're pretending, of course, that North Korea is independent and we can get China and Russia to help us, you know, and this world order will work and we'll all bring sanctions on North Korea. And it's all a fraud. It's all a sham. It's all for public consumption here at home because they don't really want the American people to know that Communist China and Communist Russia are both helping North Korea with their nuclear program and with their missile program. And then who is building up Communist China today and pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into that totalitarian nation? why the United States, under one guise or another, whether it be the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Agency for Eastern Asian Development, Agency for International Development, Goldman Sachs, our major banks, our major corporations, Intel, General Motors, go right down the line. They're all funneling massive amounts of money into communist China to build up their economic and military potential, and once again, building the best enemy money can buy. Joe, please go on.
Well, you know, the nuclear test by North Korea has had a very negative impact on South Korea's sunshine policy. South Korean government is a far left of center government that is very, very friendly to North Korea. They have a deliberate policy of appeasement with the North. Those who see this policy as dangerous, a growing number of South Koreans, and misguided, have been somewhat vindicated by Pyongyang's continued radical behavior. Yet it doesn't appear that any of this matters because the U.S. still has continued to push the candidacy of South Korea's Foreign Minister Ban Ki-moon as General Secretary of the United Nations, and he was unanimously accepted today as the new replacement for Kofi Annan. Now, it's my opinion that the reason why Foreign Minister Ban was selected is specifically because the United States wants to make sure that the sunshine policy is further protected and expanded throughout the international community. And certainly they can depend upon the new Secretary General from South Korea to promote this and to soften the blow, to continue to shepherd this embarrassing situation to the United States away from the United States' position and into the UN's hands.
In other words, what you're saying is we're saying one thing and doing another.
Absolutely. We're saying we're going to be tough on North Korea, but in fact we want someone like Ban Ki-moon in there who will in fact not be tough on North Korea because he believes in this so-called sunshine policy. Well, this particular foreign minister also has ties to the Reverend Sun Moon. Reverend Moon, of course, who deems himself kind of a surrogate savior of the world, has funneled a lot of money into North Korea. He's invested in hotels there, a Fiat automobile plant. One wonders where he gets all the billions of dollars. He claims that he sells in his Unification Church, people sell religious trinkets in Japan. I doubt very strongly whether that accounts for the many, many millions and billions of dollars which he disperses around the world.
Including the Washington Times, a supposedly conservative newspaper in Washington, D.C., the conservative counterpart to the Washington Post, and, of course, the Washington Times tells you all the news they want you to hear, and the really important issues you'll never hear addressed. But, Reverend Moon has put literally hundreds of millions of dollars into the Washington Times, and I've always felt that he was working for some intelligence agency, and I don't think it's the Korean intelligence agency.
Actually, he does have links to the Korean intelligence agency.
Well, I'm sure he does.
But like the Pakistani ISI, Dr. Stan, the Korean intelligence agency is also a surrogate of the CIA.
That's what I was hoping you'd bring up, right?
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that I think that the CIA always tries to use with double agents. They try to use third parties to fund them. It's just like Al-Qaeda. They use the Pakistani ISI to fund and to direct Al-Qaeda so that they don't have to, or the people in Al-Qaeda don't realize that the CIA is the main director there of their high-profile terrorist events. And that's what, Sun Yat-moon is one who's essentially influenced the conservative movement, spread money around in the conservative movement, and is essentially a shill for the Bush administration, which is a shill for globalism.
In other words, you fund the liberals, you fund the conservatives, you fund the right, you fund the left, you fund the Democrats, you fund the Republicans, and you always have a controlled opposition. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen, and I think that's really such an important principle, and I'm sure Joel is right, Reverend Moon is tied to the Korean intelligence, but they're tied, as are almost every intelligence agency in the world, right into our own CIA. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. Joel, please pick up the story there.
If anybody wants to get a sample copy of this week's World
Affairs
Brief...
Oh, it'd be better if we wait until about 3 minutes until we all have all of our stations on board.
Oh, all right.
Go right ahead. Don't you remember that in about 3 minutes I will bring that subject up.
All right. In the same news conference where Bush essentially was pushed into a corner by the press about the relative hypocrisy of the position with Iran versus North Korea, he was also cornered about the border fence. As I pointed out in the previous World Affairs Brief, the bill that he signed for the funding of the Department of Homeland Security actually doesn't require that a fence being is built. It doesn't even specify a physical fence, a double barrier fence, nothing of the sort. It just simply states generally a security barrier. And Michael Chertoff of the Department of Homeland Security came out at a public news conference and says his version of that fence is going to be a virtual fence, meaning with surveillance equipment. He's already let out the contract to Boeing to provide that high security equipment, including drones, and that he has no intention to build a fence. So the press cornered the president about that, and they said, you have said that you have signed the border fence bill to build 700 miles of fencing along the U.S. border, but Department of Homeland Security said it prefers a virtual fence of sensors and cameras rather than an actual wall. Are you committed to building the fence? Actual fencing, they asked. And Bush says, yeah, we're going to do both. We're just going to make sure that we build in a spot where it works. So I think what he's saying is he's on the spot. The Internet has made a great deal of this, as well as our site. And obviously the White House reads these criticisms and prepares the president for them. I don't believe we're going to see 700 miles of fencing. I think we're going to see additional fencing around large border cities where it shows, where they can showcase that. But I think most of the time they're going to use surveillance alone. And as I pointed out in the brief, President Bush is absolutely wrong when he says you can't fence the entire border. You can very well fence the border. In fact, it's cheaper in the long run than the high cost of running a surveillance and capture operation. Only a physical fence reduces the burden on the Border Patrol. Surveillance alone is not only very expensive, it requires having to determine where they are, if you even see them all at one time. You have to track them as they're going across the border, which is very difficult to do once they get away from the cameras and the fences. And there aren't enough UAVs or unmanned vehicles.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking about whether or not there's going to ever really be a fence built along the border between the United States and Mexico. And, of course, it's a 2,000-mile border, and they've agreed to maybe build a 700-mile fence. I would point out that they have built a 2,000-mile fence along the border between India and Bangladesh. But you know, we can't build one here because, oh, it's too expensive, or, well, we don't know quite why we can't build it. Maybe because the Mexicans object to it. Anyway, Joel, before we go on, I want you to tell our listeners how they can actually get copies of the World Affairs Brief and get your information.
Well, the website to go to is www.worldaffairsbrief.com. That's one word, worldaffairsbrief.com. There you will see a synopsis of today's brief, and you can get a free sample of that brief just by emailing me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. That email will get to me, and I will be able to send a sample out to you so that you can review the brief. There is a modest subscription for the weekly news analysis that I put out every Friday. I encourage people to get that. It's very difficult to get the truth. There's so much. In fact, I even have an article on my website called How to Analyze the News, and it's very important to understand that even conservative news sites are often funded by people who are part of the establishment trying to control the conservative side of the Internet. And so many of these sites that have legitimate conservative causes are dependent upon a steady flow of intelligence information from organizations fronting for the CIA but playing like they are private intelligence organizations.
God, I think you're absolutely true. Would you give that email address again? Somebody requested that we get it a couple of more times.
Yes. They can write to editor@worldaffairsbrief.com.
editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. Okay, go right ahead.
Okay. So we're talking about, the relative value, between a virtual fence or a high-tech surveillance barrier and an actual fence. But I think it's extremely important to understand that the reality is that if you have, let's suppose, 2,000 miles of unfenced border and 1,000 miles fenced, not only are they going to go around the fence, but you still have the same problem and the same expense of dealing with the people coming into the United States. First of all, you don't catch them all. And secondarily, everybody that comes to the fence that is, or the non-fence that is surveilled, that is on camera, has to be caught, has to be detained, has to have reports written up, has to be put into jail, has to be given a hearing, and normally they catch and release, and they never get back across the border. Those that are kept or do show up for the hearing, they have to deport. All of that is extremely expensive. A fiscal barrier, it requires very little maintenance. You still have to have a few cameras to see if people are working on destroying the fence, but it's much more effective at stopping illegal aliens. And I believe this is indicative that our president and this administration has no intention whatsoever of shutting down the illegal flow within the border.
In fact, I commented, I think, one time recently on a program with you, how so much of everything going on today is all for show. In fact, it was about 2.5 to 3 weeks ago when Congress passed a landmark bill. They passed congressional legislation, federal legislation, making it illegal to build a tunnel under the border between Mexico and the United States. The second bit of legislation was that that if somebody was in this country illegally, and they were involved in one of these violent gangs, and they'd committed a crime, that they could be deported. Now, doesn't all the American people really feel much better now that we know that Congress is really serious about doing something about illegal immigration? So go right ahead, Joel.
Well, what's interesting is that they keep passing bills that are already on the books.
Sure.
These are just for political show. This whole 700-mile fence bill was put up by the original opponents of the fence just to get ready for this election to pacify the Republican voters who were insisting upon some type of border security. They have no intention of building it, or they're just going to build token amounts of it. But it's very important to realize that these people voted for it, even people like Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, who said, now, this is only a first step, this is a down payment, and we want to get on to the second step now, which, now that we've got physical security and enforcement taken care of, we want to give amnesty. Of course, they don't use amnesty. We want to do this workers program and give them a path to citizenship. But I can tell you that they're moving on to the path to citizenship, and if that portion of the bill passes at any point, you'll see a fast track to implementation while they drag their feet on the fence. And this is hypocrisy in the extreme.
In fact, it even gives hypocrisy a bad name. We go right ahead.
Well, the other major story about hypocrisy comes up with the Representative Mark Foley story and the follow-on Dennis Hastert story about how much did he know and when did he know it. Of course, Hastert has now made a complete and unequivocal denial that he never knew anything. This stands right in the face of testimony of one congressman and staff members on the committee of that congressman who said that they alerted his staff and told them. Now, Congressman Colby of Arizona has retracted his original statement whereby he said he talked to Hastert personally and now saying that he didn't. I have a feeling that there's pressure, extreme pressure, from the Republican establishment to salvage Hastert's reputation. When he came out a couple of days ago and said, if anybody in my staff is ever found to have withheld information from me, they're going to be history. They shouldn't be allowed to stay in Congress. Well, I thought to myself, boy, he's really shooting himself in the foot, because when an investigation shows that he, in fact, did know about something, and they prepped the way a little bit by saying that he had evidence of mild message traffic between Representative Foley. I'll tell you, as one commentator on the Diane Reams show said today, if there were any message traffic between a grown congressman and a page or a former page talking about love issues, and we're not even talking about the grossest of these emails, but just the introductory ones, asking him what he's wearing at the time and, you know, other personal issues, that would wave all kinds of red flags. Now, what we're finding out in the extreme hypocrisy of the Republican establishment here is that apparently there have been known homosexuals for several years within the Republican ranks, and there is a whole system of shielding those people from being outed by these revelations. In addition, there's a whole group of staff members that work for Republican congressmen who are gay as well. In the White House, there's a cadre of gay people that have been hired by the House, White House. They know that these people are gay, and they are, you know, continuing to offer them employment. So there is a tremendous amount of hypocrisy in the Republican establishment, and I think they're doing their very, very best to keep this under wraps. So this is really damage control going on. I think it's indicative by Representative Hastert's surety with which he made these threats to his staff, that he has made sure that whichever staff members receive that information are going to be in complete denial. They've nailed down the people and the cover that they're going to use. There may be a scapegoat or two, but essentially they're going after this other staff members who claims that he talked with the staff of Denny Hastert, and they're going to make him the liar. It's very obvious they're going to salvage Hastert's reputation and keep him as Speaker of the House. And for this, I'm extremely disappointed in the so-called moral authority of the Republicans.
Well, I think the problem is we don't have any moral authority in either political party. That's the great tragedy. I mean, you know, for years, the conservatives and the Christians rallied behind the Republicans because the Democrats were so immoral, and now we find out immorality is the guide and the policy of both political parties and their leadership.
Clear back in the 1980s, in 83 and 84, when I was in Washington during the Reagan administration as chairman of the Conservative National Committee, I found out that at the summit that the president held down in Williamsburg, that there was a huge orgy-type party that went on with the homosexual group within the Reagan White House, even, that had gone down there for their frolicking at this joint, and there was some press that leaked out about it, and it was quickly covered up. But even in the Reagan administration, it was not exempt from a protected cadre of homosexuals who were hired within the Republican White House. I'm sure we don't know all the details, Dr. Stan, and don't want to know them, but I can tell you this. I'm convinced from my experience as well of what's going on now that the cover-up is much broader than what we have seen so far.
I'm sure you're right, and I'm sure that it would be very dangerous for anybody to come out and tell the real truth, you know, because I'm sure they have things on most of the people in Congress, and if they don't have them, they'll simply make them up and do to any congressman what they did to Representative George Hansen of Idaho, where they contrive, charges, send him to prison, tortured him for on and off for 10 years, and then said, "Oh, shucks, you know, we're just so sorry, George. Why, we didn't even have any authority to put you in prison, but that's all right. We're going to let you out now and give you a pardon. Isn't that great of us?" But that was an example, I think, for any congressman who really has the courage to want to do what's right.
You know, I'm very concerned that one of the more upfront signs of something very disturbing within our political establishment, and it's certainly caught on with Republicans now, is this tendency to simply lie, do bold-faced lies before the public. Of course, you know, Bush and his administration did it about Iraq. It's even more complicated, of course, than no weapons of mass destruction. It's actually complicated because there were weapons of mass destruction. It's so convoluted, in fact, it takes me a long time to explain the nuances of what kind of confusion is going on, because now you have to understand that if the Bush administration knew that there were weapons of mass destruction, why didn't they save themselves the embarrassment of presenting the evidence to the world instead of George Bush admitting, "I was wrong, there was no weapons of mass destruction"? In fact, we know that there were, and that the Russians came in and used a long convoy of trucks and aircraft to ship them to Syria. And the U.S. has evidence. The satellite pictures were in the folder that was to be presented by Colin Powell to the United Nations, and it was pulled at the last minute. It was even the list of what Colin Powell was going to bring up to the U.N. was in the New York Times. That's where I found out that the satellite photos of the weapons being shipped to Syria was on the list, right there in the New York Times. And yet it's been successfully covered up and withdrawn.
Well, really, what bothers me about that whole story, Joel, is I'm fearful that those weapons are there in Syria and maybe even in the Baca Valley and in Lebanon, and they're going to be used one day against Israel.
Well, yes, and certainly Israel's, you know, asked for it now by doing this indiscriminate bombing of civilians in Lebanon. They've suddenly made themselves a pariah. They've lost my support as a government. I still support the overall religious community of Israel and its biblical right to a homeland there. But this government has lost all sympathy and among good people who have seen that it was just doing indiscriminate bombing of civilians to antagonize the world. It was almost doing what the United States is doing in the Middle East. And that means that their own globalist government in Israel is attempting to make them a pariah to engender more bad will in the Middle East, as if Israel needed any more bad will. So things aren't what they seem to be. You know, if there were weapons of mass destruction, the Bush administration doesn't save itself. You know, we have to ask what's going on when the Bush administration actually allows its own administration, its own government, to leak information that's damaging to it, whether it's Abu Ghraib, whether it's the news photographs of the Marines shooting prisoners. All of those things can be and have been previously suppressed. Why did they let them out now? I think it's part of a concerted plan to, as part of globalism, to antagonize the world against the United States. And the globalists themselves, I believe, have picked George Bush because he is laughable, because he does have a cowboy mentality, a limited ability to speak with any coherence in the press. He's part of the package of setting up the United States for ridicule and eventually for some massive act of retaliation.
In fact, I don't know, you probably read that editorial, up-age page editorial by Henry Kissinger last month in the Washington Post, but he basically said, you know, that we're facing a terrible, terrible situation. The war of civilizations may well be there, and we have two choices, either a new world order or a global catastrophe.
Yes, and that's what they're setting up for us.
A global catastrophe.
Yes. And we will have a global catastrophe and a new world order, and one will lead to the other. And, of course, these people set them up so that they will, even though they're part of the program, they take different sides, they switch sides, so that they could say, I told you so, and they will want to, or their followers will want to step right into leadership, no matter what happens, no matter how bad the policy, whether it's the Gulf War, whether it's the current war in Iraq. These same policy people will be in the next administration as Team B and continue to say, you know, we're the only ones deemed worthy of ruling. It's very discouraging to see how the American people continue to not hold the president's feet to the fire on these contradictions. They are too easily led by these phony excuses that explain away, and they do semi-logically explain away things. Bush can get away with saying, we're trying everything within the realm of diplomacy to get North Korea and Iran to give up their nuclear weapons program. Anyone who's close to the ground, however, knows that they have no intention of continuing diplomacy with Iran, and they have no intention of using military action on North Korea. There's an absolute double standard involved here, and it will only become apparent when they attack Iran without any proof of a nuclear program, and they continue after that to refuse to attack North Korea, then it will be apparent that this was a double standard. But I doubt if anyone's really going to pull the president on the carpet. I doubt if you'll see the same kind of confrontation that we saw in this week's news conference if we actually attack Iran. I doubt if you'll hear any reporters saying to the president, well, are you going to attack Korea now? Or he'll have a facile excuse by saying, well, we can't. We're tied up in Iran now, in Iraq, so we certainly can't. We can only do one thing at a time. I mean, he'll have an excuse, and it will appear reasonable to people. But I'm here to warn and say that there is a concerted plan to continue to protect any of the communists, the continuing Soviet Union that went underground, that still is controlled by communists, the continuing communist in China. There is a concerted effort by this administration, being globalist, to protect them, because these are going to be those that attack the United States, which leads then, when you remove the United States as a military force in the world, will lead us inexorably into that new world order, and the United States people, being the subject of a preemptive nuclear strike in this country, will cry out to our leaders who come out of their bunkers, who knew this was happening in advance. They will cry out to them, do anything to save us.
Give us
It'll make 9/11 look like a picnic.
Give us a new world order, Henry Kissinger, just like you said. We'll do anything to avoid the horror of seeing this continue. I think that's exactly what's planned, and that's what happened after the First World War. The people of Europe were willing to give up all sovereignty and their freedom.
Yes, it's very sad, and, you know, they couldn't pull it off then. They had to just take a half of a bite, and they got that with the start of the UN. The UN's never had any enforcement power, and now this next war is going to move us into the realm where the UN has enforcement power, and that power to enforce our own national will be removed from nation states. And they'll still use the verbiage that we're sovereign nations. They'll throw out the word sovereignty, just as they're doing in Iraq, but Iraq is clearly not sovereign, and neither will we be when we go into that new world order.
Well, I think they're exciting times, and I think unless we understand that there are spiritual forces, really, I believe, behind everything that's going on, you end up just scratching your head and saying it doesn't make any sense and just sort of giving up trying to understand it. But I think if you understand the spiritual implications of what's going on, why, everything begins to fit into a pattern, and I think you're absolutely right. I think it's only a matter of time until we are involved in some sort of a nuclear confrontation, and I think that the average American finds that impossible to believe.
Well, and one of the reasons why it's so hard to believe is that they don't ever let us feel the full impact of these erroneous policies. We're never allowed to feel the impact of these wars because we're not taxed for them. They use deficit spending, and slowly inflation is rising, but that's blamed on the free market economy. That's not blamed on Iraq. But that's one of the reasons why we've been printing and creating credit to the tune of about 10% of our currency each year. So it's inflation's much higher than what the CPI figures are.
And then they keep the American casualty count down. Certainly, it's frightening when you think of the number of men have been killed, men and women killed and injured over there, but nothing like it was in Vietnam. And then, of course, anytime anybody talks about the Iraqi casualties, why, well, they say that could not be true. I mean, after the president said there are only 30,000 Iraqi civilians killed, and the recent figures are estimated about 600,000 Iraqis have been killed.
That's right. Of course, they're disputing that. The president says that's not credible. But how do you know if you don't keep figures, and the government purposely doesn't keep figures on Iraqi casualties because they don't want to know? But you just look at the rate that they're being killed in Baghdad alone, and you know that it's much, much higher than 30,000.
Well, I think we're in very, very difficult times. I think men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose, and I think I hope our listeners will heed what Joel Skousen has said. Our guest this evening has been Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and it's always a pleasure having you on. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week, Joel.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night, and God bless. All right. Well, this is Joel Skousen, and certainly we live in very, very frightening times. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and let me just comment that you really should go to World Affairs Brief every evening, pardon me, or every morning, or every evening. I go there every morning because I want to know, of course, what the news is, and it keeps you right on the cutting edge of all the latest stories. And you know, you start your day that way, you know what's really going on in the world. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family and helping us as we reach out across America on 60 different outlets every week. Now, some of the stations were just on once a week, some are on every day, and a number of them are on every day. But believe me, it's an expensive proposition, and quite frankly, we do need your help. If you believe, as I do, that we're involved in the spiritual battle, for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then let me remind you that, once again, that we are having our yearly seminar. It's going to be on the 29th of October. That's the last Sunday of this month, and it's going to be all day long at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. And if you can possibly make it, we hope you'll be there. And we're going to bring in Constance Cumby from Michigan. We're going to bring Chris Pitto in from Southern California. We've got a great lineup of speakers and information that you really need. And there'll be all sorts of books and tapes and videos and, of course, everything imaginable there that you will need for times like these. And there'll be other information that we'll be making readily available to you. So we need to know this week, if you're going to be able to come, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, you're going to be sending us a check. Why, we do need to get that check in right away so that we'll have it here so we can have hold a place for you. And certainly we've got it in a week or so. But if you're thinking about coming, we'd certainly like to know. 1-800-544-8927. Now, if you'd like to really understand what's going on over in Iraq today, you need to understand who runs America. And you need to understand what energizes them. You'll certainly want to get a copy of my August newsletter. It's up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. And of course, we'll be glad to send you a free copy if you do not have access to the Internet, if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. But remember, you can go to our website, read all of our newsletters. You have our permission to copy them. In fact, you have our permission to copy any of our videos or any of our four tape sets or anything we have written and circulated, as long as you're not doing it for profit. We need your help to get the information out. We can only reach so many people 5 hours a day, but every one of you out there can reach other people. And don't get discouraged if they don't want to hear what you have to say. Ask them some questions about what would happen to them. If simply the economy of this nation were to collapse. What would happen to them if suddenly their pension fund really had no value? What would happen to them if there was a nuclear attack on America and the whole structure of society broke down? And then, of course, simply point out some of the things that you hear on this program and just try to get them to think. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or seen the video or DVD, let me suggest this is a good place to start. The book has changed people's lives, and it's brought some people into a personal relationship with our Lord. And then, of course, you can always ask those very key questions, and that is, if you were to die today, where would you spend eternity? And, of course, then the next question would be, and if you were to stand before the gates of heaven and were to be asked why you should be admitted, what would you say? And if people say that they've been a good person, that's the wrong answer, and you need to know the answer so you can counsel them. Because one of the most important things we can do is try to bring people into a personal relationship with our Lord and understand the spiritual element of everything that's going on today. So this is the time, of course, when we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if America does not turn back to God, we're going to lose this country. And because everything that's going on today has a spiritual connotation, then we ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry and pray for my staff, my family, and pray for our provision and protection. Good night.
morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of God's creation. It is the 13th of October, Friday the 13th, 2006, and I know that folks that listened to Shill O'Reilly last night, maybe they are just now starting to get it.